bring this down?
Absolutely.
I'm kind of short. Oh no, I think I messed it up.
No.
Yeah, I did something to it. I jacked it up. Yeah, I don't know. I messed it up.
Let's try it up here.
That one? Oops.
Okay.
Thanks, Jerry.
Good afternoon. My name's Teresa. I'm an alcoholic.
Teresa.
Grateful to be here. Grateful to be sober because of a loving God. I feel like I'm going to cry. I'm praying big time. I just feel like I don't have a filter at the moment. So I was like, I gotta pause when agitated. I'm pausing. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come out and participate in my recovery. Thank Dee Dee for her patience and helping me and picking me up and trying to arrange me getting here and safely and getting to my room. I want to apologize in advance. I told them I probably won't be my best. I'm really tired. I was on a red eye. And so I'm just, you know, later on tomorrow I'll probably be bouncing, hey, hi. Right now I'm like, whatever. Just don't drink or use no matter what. Let's go home. That's kind of how I'm feeling at the moment. And, you know, I always have a share before I share, and that is that no matter what, I mean, despite the fact that I'm really tired and lots going on in my life right now, I'm always nervous, and I always find this to be extremely awkward and vulnerable. It's not something that I believe I signed up for. I still talk to my sponsor often about not doing this anymore. Actually, my grand sponsor took a year off, and I was like, why can't I do that? So it's uncomfortable, and I like to say that a lot of times because then the rest of my share is awkward, right? Because I'm trying to be cool, but I'm not. So usually I have a lot of anxiety, and my heart's coming out of my chest. And in some ways, I was looking forward to it being so early in the afternoon on Friday that it'd probably be about 20 of us, but that was kind of like the flip side of my enthusiasm of this idea. But no, there's a bunch of y'all out there. My sobriety date is March 29, 1990. I've had the honor and the privilege of being with you for the last 27 years. This is my first time in the program. I am a first timer. A lot of times I like to share that. There are those of us who come here and stay. At least the Big Book talks about at least 50% of us who really try, we get to stay here. I have yet to go out. I don't say I have yet to find it necessary because I have found it necessary. But I learned that that's in yet for me, and yet means you're eligible too. And so thank God we only do this one day at a time, sometimes 1 minute at a time. And then months go by and years, and here I am. I've been sharing this often, I guess, until it changes for me, and that is that I am now sober longer than I was drinking. And yay. And this program has become a working part of my mind and my body, and this has become the norm. And what it was like is a story and an experience that I had, and I don't ever want to forget her. I believe that if I forget what it was like or I forget her, I'm bound to repeat it. I want to welcome our new friends. Welcome home. We've been praying for you, and we ask you to keep coming back. You know, I want to share with the newcomer. I was thinking about this as I was getting ready in my room, that because I always ask, you know, we talk about willing to go to any lengths. And I'm like, really, God? I don't get it. What am I doing here? But I thought about the newcomer. And I'm here for you. I'm here for three reasons, actually. One is because of the grace of a loving God. And the other is for the newcomer, the new man or woman that's out there that couldn't care less what's going on in my life or the fact that I'm tired. I know that I sat in rooms like this and people carried the message to me and it changed my life and it gave me hope. And there are so many nuggets that I receive from conferences like this that I still hold on to that carries me in my sobriety. And so it is incumbent upon me that despite myself, I give back what was so freely given to me. And so I'm here for you. And the other reason is I want to stay sober. Sobriety is the most important thing in my life. And if this is what it means to show up and suit up so that I can have another 24 hours, then I'm going to do it. And I'm so glad you're here, those of you who are new. And it's going to be all right. Just keep coming back. And all the old timers in the house, thank you for my life and my sobriety. I always share this. I still want what you have, and I don't ever want to lose that. And I'm so grateful that you keep showing up and letting me know that I too can recover one day at a time. I watch the old timers and I learn from you and I listen and I watch them continuously show up. And I always say what impresses me the most about the old timers is not so much that they've stayed sober, because I've come to understand that this program works if you work it, but is that they haven't killed themselves or somebody else. Because after a while, that becomes an option. No? I'm going to share in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And I invite you to listen to similarities and not the differences. And ask yourself some questions like, that happened to me. I felt that way too. And more importantly, perhaps this program can work for me. My relationship with alcohol begins in the womb. And so I'm one of those who drank in my mother's belly. I'm born addicted. My mother's an alcoholic, in Alcoholics Anonymous. Mommy in October celebrated 30 years. And so when I came out of my mom's belly, I was screaming and crying, and I'm born addicted. And when I came home, that was the only thing they gave me was alcohol, because that was the only thing I could ingest. That was the only thing I would receive. I wouldn't take juice or formula, and so they fed me alcohol, my grandmother and my father. And then mommy made sure that I had alcohol in my system 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This part of my story doesn't change, and a lot of stuff is coming up for me in this area. And that was that mom didn't want me. And so when she left me in the hospital and told my father to take it away from her, when I came home and they left me alone in the house with her to eventually have her touch me or look at me, I began to cry, and she was trying to tell them to shut me up. And when she realized she was alone in the house with me, she went to the bassinet with a pillow, and she felt that was her opportunity to finally kill me. And she was smothering me. And for whatever reason, mommy recalled hearing them say, if you give her alcohol, she'll stop crying. And that's really where my relationship with alcohol really, really begins. I think that my grandmother and my father felt that they would give me alcohol and eventually taper me off as I detoxed or something. But mommy realized that as long as I had alcohol in my bottle, I would never be seen or heard. And that was her way of helping me to be non-existent. And so I described my relationship with alcohol as a love affair. Alcohol was my oxygen. It was my friend and my companion. It was my lover. It was the only thing I knew. I didn't learn about food, really learn about food, until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was always malnourished and very sickly. I was in and out of the hospital. Most of the time I received my nutrition through, they put it in the bag, you know, like this is clear liquid that you get nutrition. I don't know why they never removed me from the home or social services came in. It was in the 60s. I don't know. But they would always just give me nutrients from the bag and send me back. I spent a lot of holidays in the hospital. It was funny, one of my mother's old friends was reminding me of that the other day. And so I was always very frail and tiny and sick. My brother never understood the relationship between my mother, myself, and alcohol. There were many times my brother tried to save me from that. And he would try to make excuses so he could take me out of the house or take the bottle from my mouth. And he tried really hard to help me. I think about a story he had told me that he's 3 years older than me, and he was 8 and I was 5. And he said he was just so tired of what was happening to me that he packed up our little suitcase and told mommy he was taking me away. And he said he got downstairs and realized he didn't know where to go. He was 8 and I was 5. And then he went back upstairs, and he had said at that time he swore that he was always going to find a way to get me out of the house. And it wasn't until years later when he went into the military that I discovered that was his goal of rescuing me. And then I always like to sum up some adjectives of the way in which I grew up in the first 24 years of my life. And these are the adjectives in which you gave me. And that was that you say I come from a dysfunctional family. To this day, it's the same family that I had then that I have now. Everyone are alcoholics and they're addicts. They're crazy as they could be. I later on grew up with a lot of cartel and mafia, and I saw strength in them. I saw them being really strong and had a lot of power and control in their communities. There wasn't any shame behind, you know what I mean, who they were. They're well respected. But you call that dysfunctional. And I grew up hearing things like, you're stupid, you're an idiot, nobody loves you, nobody wants you, we can't wait till you die, get out of my face. And you call that verbal abuse. That's what you told me when I came here. And people kick me, punch me. I've been pistol whipped, I've been stabbed, I've been poked, I've been spit on. And that was happening on a regular basis. It wasn't only now and then. It was just all the time when everybody felt like punching me in the face or the stomach. They did for whatever reason. Everything was my fault or whatever. And you call that physical abuse, is what you told me. And men and women took turns with my body and had sex with me whenever they felt like it. Whether it was neighbors, cousins, uncles, babysitters, friends, and you call that sexual abuse. And you know, alcohol helped me not to be present for any of that. I don't know if alcohol spoke to you, but it spoke to me. And it told me, if nobody loves you, I love you. And you don't have to worry about any of this. I'll take care of you. And I grew up for the first, you know, the 24 years of my life, it was me and alcohol against the world. And nothing and nobody mattered but my booze. It was It was, as long as I had my drink, you can pound on me and you can kick me and you can have sex with me and you could say whatever you want to me. And it just didn't matter. It didn't matter. I didn't cry. I didn't say I wanted to run away. I never said something was wrong with that. I thought that was normal and that's just the way it was. And alcohol allowed me not to even have a heartbeat. I was completely detached and disconnected emotionally. I had no feelings. I wasn't shocked about anything. I've seen therapists and social workers and two-way mirrors. Mommy was always suicidal and in and out of mental institutions. And I would always have a smile on my face. And they would ask me, is anything wrong? And I would say, no, everything is fantastic. And I would be bleeding. I would have all kinds of things going on. And they would be, but look at you. You're like bleeding. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. Do I need stitches? How do we move on from this? I was emancipated at the age of 14. A judge, I said at the time that I was too mature to put me into foster care. My IQ was completely ridiculous, that I could do the judge's job at that moment if I needed to. The judge also told my mother that I was not a juvenile delinquent. I did not have issues with authority figures. The only thing that the doctors didn't understand, that as respectful and mindful as I was, that if they left me in the room longer than 15 minutes with my mother, I would turn into something else. They didn't understand. And he felt that the issue was my mother. When you talk about alcohol or anything else, that mommy was the issue. I had my own business at that time. My boyfriend was 11 years my senior. And so I got emancipated. And I was left to my own devices to go out into the world and to figure things out. And, you know, the sad thing about that was I had this genius IQ and it wasn't cultivated. I didn't know what to do with that. I used that IQ to survive and to hustle and to live. And I can mimic jobs and I got into politics and I would just say I want to do something and I would just go do it. Nothing and nobody got in between me and my booze, ever. I didn't share my drink. I didn't buy rounds for people. I didn't have to go to parties to look for alcohol. I didn't have to hang out in bars. It was always in my house. And the well never went dry. And I would sip my drinks. I wouldn't dance butt naked on tables. I wasn't chug-a-lugging. I sipped my drinks just like I did when they gave it to me in the bottle. You know, to this day, whether I go to my grammar school reunion or my high school reunion or visit my family, they're still shocked that I say that I'm an alcoholic because they always saw me drink like a lady, according to them. What they didn't realize was that I never could be without, right? I always had to have it. I still drink, in a way, liquids the same way. This bottle that Dee Dee gave me when I arrived, I will probably be drinking that bottle of water until I leave here. And the only reason why I won't be able to finish it is because I can't take it through TSA when I leave through the airport. And as long as I'm sipping on it, I'm good. And that's the way I drank. I took a lot of risks. I took a lot of chances. I hung out with what you call scrupulous people. I associated with people that I thought were less than me. I was into money, property, and prestige. I made sure that I was always in charge of something or running some kind of company. Same time, I almost graduated from Catholic school. And I would put a uniform on and a smile on my face and say the Our Father and the Hail Mary. You know, I really thought nothing was wrong with that life. I always like to share that. You know, I never questioned it. I never said, perhaps it should be different. I don't even remember looking at people or my neighbors or girlfriends saying, maybe I should be with this family. This was my life. And I thought that I was going to have the opportunity to die early like everybody else in my family. We die from cirrhosis of the liver or kidney failure. and you fall down, you crack your skull, or you get shot, or you OD. And in my family, we celebrate death, and we cry when a baby is born. I wasn't planning on changing that life. But for whatever reason, around the age of 24, the only way I can describe it is that alcohol betrayed me. And it turned its back on me. And it left me emotionally retarded with no coping skills. You say alcohol stops working. And perhaps that's what happened to me. All I know was that all of a sudden I became present from my experience. And it was as though I had been living in a coma and I had never really been present or existed in this thing you call life. And when alcohol stopped working, all of a sudden it's as though somebody resuscitated me and I'm now 24 and I've been living on this planet physically for 24 years, but I had never been here. And so it scared the living daylights out of me. And I didn't know what to do with that. Because alcohol would tell me when to get up in the morning and when to go to bed at night. If I was going to work, if I wasn't. Where I was going to live, where I wasn't going to live. If I was in a relationship and if I was not. It dictated every single area of my life. And so when it stopped working, I didn't know how to breathe. I didn't know how to get up. I didn't know how to walk, talk, sit, dress, sleep. I knew nothing. My total reliance and dependence was alcohol allowing me to function. I lived in a blackout for 24 years, so that means I didn't know my name. It was as though I was in a coma or something. You know when people come out of a coma or amnesia? I didn't know my name. I didn't know who the people were around me. Till this day, most of my story is other people's story. When I go to my high school reunion or grammar school or see my girlfriends that I grew up with, they always show up with pictures and they tell me stories. You know, I'm so grateful for that. You know, they're so cute. They always come and like, remember when we did this, and they explain things to me. My brother was my memory. After I got sober, things would come to me and I would call my brother and tell him, you know, for example, I see like a brown couch. What is that? And he would tell me where that brown couch was and where we lived and what was going on at the time. And so I was terrified. And I started trying every combination necessary to allow my heart to be flatlined again so I can check out again. And no matter what I did, I was still restless, irritable, and discontent. And what I've heard around here is that incomprehensible demoralization is a whole lot of things. But when you can't get sober and you can't get drunk is the worst place for an alcoholic like me to be. And now I began to hear the name calling. And I began to feel the punches and the kicks and the hits. And no matter what I did, no matter what combination I tried to incorporate, I was still present from my experience. And I really believe that's when things change. There's so many stories that I hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I come to understand about this allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And that's what we have in common. But we come from all sorts of walks of life. Where there are people in these rooms that grew up with two loving parents that gave them everything and provided a safe and loving environment, but yet something was different. And regardless of how I was born addicted, I too am like you. You know, I'm grateful for good sponsorship. I remember my sponsor telling me, you may not be responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. Because for years, I blamed my alcoholism on my mother and in my family. I don't remember when I made a conscious choice to drink. And now I'm in this world that all I know how to do is exist with alcohol and I can't function. So what is a drunk like me supposed to do? Where am I supposed to go? I can't even breathe without it. And so I'm suffocating, I'm lost, I'm scared, I'm confused. And the only thing that I can come up with was to invite death into my life. Because I can't do another 24 hours like that. And I think it's a cold thing when you invite death in your life and death don't even take you out. When that is the only option, right? The best solution. At this time, I'm pregnant on my fourth child. I've lost three prior. All my babies usually fall out in toilets and floors, all of them. My womb was always so polluted and so toxic, I couldn't keep a child. Most of the time, I wouldn't realize I was pregnant until it fell on the floor or something, and I would flush it and keep walking. This baby's not falling out in the toilet like the other ones, and it's doing very strange things to my body. Everybody's moving too fast. The sun burns my skin. It's too bright. I can't take a bath because it hurts. You know, the good old days is I can get sodomized, gang raped, and pistol whipped. And I go to the bathroom. I fix my hair. I put on my makeup. I straighten out my clothes, I take a drink, and I do it all over again. Those are the good old days. But now I couldn't leave the bathroom. And I looked in the mirror, and I didn't know who she was. And this night came, I went to see this Colombian. You know, this is really what happened. Like, the last, my last. I went to see a Colombian. I had a contract out for my life. I remember my uncle came to see me and he said, you know you're in trouble when the good guys are looking for you and the bad guys. And I knew for sure that this Colombian would take me out. And I waited for him for 2 hours and he never showed up. They threw me out of where he hangs out at. And I did the aimless walk, the walk with no purpose, no agenda, no destination. It's just a walk. And I ended up in a church, that's all. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says only an act of providence can help a drunk like me. But for the grace of God, I stand before you sober today. I can't tell you that when I stepped inside that church, I was surrendered or I was completely done. All I knew that in that moment, there I stood. Isolation, desperation, bewilderment in that moment. And the window of the grace of God opened up. And I said a prayer. And I think it's a prayer that's different than other prayers. And I said, God, please allow me to feel the peace that I feel in this church inside of me. And I just wanted one moment for my head to shut up, my skin to stop crawling, and for my stomach to stop turning, just for a second, man, so I can get a grip. I had no idea that prayer was going to change my life. I didn't even know what I was praying to. I just felt a presence in that church. I left there. I went to my father's house. And Daddy opened up the door and looked at me. And at this time, Daddy wasn't talking to me anymore. And normally he would open the door and he would just walk away. He would let me sleep there, but he wouldn't say anything to me. But this time he opened up the door and he just stood there staring at me. And I said, Daddy, help me. And I said, I'm tired, Daddy. I can't live like this no more. I'm scared. And I can't breathe. And my father said, with all the love that a father had for his daughter, he always wanted me. And he was so powerless over alcoholism. There was nothing he could do to change what was happening to me. He said he had to watch me slowly die. He wished he could lock me up or put me in a closet or kidnap me. You know what I mean? And he wished, but he knew that there was nothing he could do. But he told me, you're standing in the middle of a crossroad and that there was three directions I was headed. I was so close to them, I could taste them, I could smell them, and that was jails, mental institutions, and death. But there was another road, it was called recovery, that I could give it a try. And if it didn't work out, the other three would be waiting for me. And my dad and my stepmom put me on a Greyhound bus, and I headed out to California, where my mother is sober and my cousin. And I detoxed on that Greyhound bus. I had my last drink in El Paso, Texas. There was a man on that bus who gave me a drink. He carried me to the bar. I was so sick. I was having DTs. I hadn't been without a drink in my body since fetus. I was sick. More people die from alcohol detox than anything else. I could have died on that bus. And I arrived in downtown Los Angeles on March 29, 1990. Wearing a size 1 pair of pants with 2 pants underneath, a huge sweatshirt, 4 months pregnant with a dead baby in my belly. I didn't have a heartbeat by the time I got to California. I have not had the honor and the privilege of having children ever since. Every time I've gone to the doctor, I'm reminded of how damaged my insides are. Now I'm in my 50s. I just celebrated on Sunday 52. I'm going through menopause. That's a whole other experience. That's a new experience. Changes things up a little bit. I feel like I'm going crazy, you know? And my mother picked me up from Union Station, and she dropped me off in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because you told her to. She couldn't help me. Mommy left me in the rooms. And she turned me over to the people who saved her life. They told her to just drop me off. I can't listen to mommy. She did as far as what she can do, and that was to be an attraction. But for mommy to stay with me and hang out with me in recovery, I know people get sober together. I know families hang out and they go to meetings. And sometimes I write about how jealous I am where families get sober and hang out with one another. I haven't been able to hang out with my family in sobriety. To this day, I only go to the meetings that mommy goes to when she's taking a cake. And whenever I show up at that meeting, randomly, they always go, oh my God, what did your mother do? What happened? You know. So I go to her meetings as an Al-Anon, a sick Al-Anon, talking about where's her sponsor? Is this her home group? And they're like, uh-oh, what did Sonya do? And I'm so grateful for all the old timers who were there when I got there. I got sober in 9604, which is on 96 and Figueroa in South Central, and Crenshaw Alano. I also have Back to Basics, still my home. I say I'm so proud of the breed that I come from. I always feel like a baby in a baby basket left at the doorsteps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The old timers picked up that basket and they brought me into the room. And I remember them saying, hey, baby, we've been praying for you. And I thought it was because they knew mommy, but I realized that you guys pray for everybody, no? We have a moment of silence. Yeah. You prayed me up in here. They gave me a sponsor. I didn't pick her, interview her, fire her, change her. I don't know what's going on with that today. They told me that this woman was my sponsor. And all I needed to know was that she had a working knowledge of the steps in the book. The rest was none of my business. They sat me in the front and they told me to listen like the dying only could. That my first assignment when I came here was to examine my relationship with alcohol. And that the very first step in recovery was to concede to my innermost self that I was truly alcoholic. And I had to listen to you. And as you began to tell your stories, I started to realize that the life that I had been living was not normal. I began to understand this thing called an illness, or it's called the disease of alcoholism, and how it manifests in our bodies and in our minds and in our spirits. And I sat down and I shut up and I listened. And I just listened to you people. And I was in awe of the things that I heard from these podiums. I love the redundancy, where they would get up to the program and say, the program is outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You too can recover. You don't have to take a drink again if you want to, more importantly, and if you don't want to. The program works if you work it. Follow the black on the white. We have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Man, I loved hearing that over and over again. This woman, Marcy, used to say, baby girl, God don't make no junk. That's what she used to tell me. I used to be like, what are you saying to me? My whole life they told me I was junk. She told me, you a child of God. You deserve to be here. Oh man, I just enjoyed the fellowship and the spirit and the respect and compassion and love. I witnessed things in here that I had not seen before in my life. There was a tenderness, but yet a sternness and a discipline that they gave me. I remember we couldn't walk around talking about, well, you know, we can't be perfect or something like that people say, right? We're not perfect. And they just say, no, but we strive for spiritual progress. I used to hear things like, you need to walk like you talk. In the quietness of your own space, how you live in. Man, that stuff still rings in my head. I didn't realize that they were helping me to build self-esteem and self-worth by having me put up the chairs and sweep the floors and clean out the coffee cups. And I began to listen to you. I was just telling a sponsee of mine, no, not even a sponsee, this guy in Canada, that I learned from you what insanity looked like. And I also learned from you what sanity was and what insanity wasn't. And I looked to you for hope. I heard how sane you were. And I would be like, how do you get that? How do you not be what I had always been? I want what you have. I want this sense of self, a sense of knowing. I looked at these old timers, these women. I remember them. So many of them are now in the big meeting in the sky. Man, they were such ladies. Helen Louise would just have her hat on and she would just sit up, man. When I think about it, you know what I mean? It was just like, what is that? What is that that she had? This sense of self, I can't even describe it. We call it the sunlight of the spirit. My goodness, it was beautiful. And Miss Iona, and they lived a hard life, and they've been through so much, and they shared their experience, strength, and hope with me. And no matter what I had been through it, somebody in that room had gone through that too. And they began to remove the shame. And they told me that there was a solution. That the life that I had lived, I no longer had to live it anymore, if I was willing. And they told me all I needed was a mustard seed of willingness. Just a mustard seed. Not a whole lot. I still hear Ralph. Ralph, I love Ralph so much. Ralph White, he speaks a lot, man. I love him. And he heard this and he would share it, so then I heard it from him. And in the meetings, he would hear people say, you may not want what I have. You may not want what we have. But in the quietness of your own space tonight, ask yourself if you want what you have. Man, they used to mess me up. I'd be like, oh, man, I can't get away with nothing. They gave me these tools, and they said that these tools are designed for living. They weren't exercises. They're not homework. They're not assignments to give to my sponsor. I put down the drink and I picked up the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor gave me a working knowledge of the steps and the book. And how do I incorporate them in my daily life? And so if I needed a drink to wake up in the morning, I needed the steps to wake up in the morning. If I needed a drink to go to sleep, remember, it dictated every area of my life. So I needed the steps. You began to explain to me that what I have is an illness that is so powerful that no human power is going to relieve me of my alcoholism. That self-knowledge served me nothing. My IQ was irrelevant. That I had to dummy up around here. Let's just say, dummy up quick. Anytime I would say, I know, they'd be like, that's the problem. Right? That's the problem. That once I put the plug in the jug, I was in far more trouble than I ever was before. That I suffered from a soul sickness. It was a spiritual malady. And that this was a spiritual program of action and more action. And that I needed to tap into a source of power to do for me what I could not do for myself. And it is not too far off from the way I had my relationship with alcohol. Perhaps that idea didn't come too difficult for me. For you see, Teresa has never run on any kind of self-will. I don't even know what that is. My total reliance and dependence was always on a source bigger than me, and that was alcohol. And now you are going to introduce me to another higher power, but this higher power was not going to put me in situations that were going to shame me or demoralize me or to wipe me away from the people that I love and I care about. That's what you told me. And so I wanted to find that power. That when I woke up in the morning, it gave me a breath of life and joy. I wanted to find that power that you explained gave you compassion and forgiveness and love, because alcohol was my higher power, didn't give me that. It gave me nothing but pain, suffering, and misery. Huh? And I began to practice these steps to go on the inside to find this power. Man, what a journey it's been in 27 years. You taught me how to love and you've opened up my heart. What a beautiful thing, this thing called love. I've also learned what it is to be heartbroken. Very painful. I've learned what it is to laugh. Oh my goodness, I like laughing. I've also learned what it is to cry. Everything for me in Alcoholics Anonymous has been new. I've been growing up along these spiritual lines. I've been maturing. I came to you emotionally an infant. I always say I met God butt naked alone with a white flag up my ass. I can't say that nicely. Yeah. I was homeless in my fifth year, and a woman said, sometimes, Teresa, we got to meet God naked and alone. And I added the white flag part, you know, to describe how I was feeling. And I held on to that. Life's been in session for me. I'm grateful for the foundation that Alcoholics Anonymous has continued to incorporate and give me. My sobriety has not been the easiest because I've been learning how to live this thing called life. I've been spending all these years learning what's normal and what's not normal. Developing and this relationship with this power that sometimes doesn't seem so tangible, only sometimes through people. I said, God, take all of me, good or bad. What will you have me be and what will you have me do? Again, because I used to hear Ralph say, sobriety is a gift given to me by God, and what I do with it is my gift to God. We talk about living two lifestyles in one lifetime. I've learned to be transparent. I heard things like, you're as sick as your secrets. And I come into these rooms because it is a safe place for me to share with you and tell you exactly what's going on with Teresa and what my disease is saying in my head so I could take the power out of it. I've learned the gift of forgiveness. That mother I told you about, mommy has Alzheimer's. I take care of mommy. Take an alcoholic who just goes to meetings with Alzheimer's. Boy, she stretches my spiritual muscles. Before coming here, it was difficult. Mommy was crying. I was trying to do her medicine and get her to have lunch, and I don't know, something happened. And so I have to trust that God's taking care of her right now. When I go out of town, she doesn't act so well. Most of you have heard me share, the last 4 years I've learned about grief and loss. There was only a couple of people in my life that loved me unconditionally, who loved me before I got sober and really enjoyed watching me be sober. It was my brother and my father. Oh my goodness, sobriety for them was a gift for them too, because they knew that finally I was where I needed to be and I was safe. And I lost them. It was 4 years now, my brother and my father. It has been very difficult for me. My life has shifted in ways that I can't even explain. I've been the caregiver when I said, God, take all of me. It's not because I've run on self-will. It's been through thorough writing and inventory and talking to my sponsor. I learned that when you think you're talking to a burning bush, you need to talk to somebody about that. And I've had to practice the gift of forgiveness, and I've been the caregiver to most of my perpetrators and my abusers. I've set up hospice 7-8 times. I've gone financially broke as a result of it, but blessed, as my sponsor told me, that I was in a position to do so, bury people, you know what I mean? Take time, you know what I mean? It takes a lot when people are very, very sick. And in all that, continue to have an attitude of gratitude. And ask God, where will you have me be? What will you have me do? My brother has two boys. As I told you, I didn't get to have children, but I've had the honor of helping to raise these two boys that are now 14 and 18. And they love their titi very, very much. Sometimes they say, you know, titi, we think you don't have kids so that you can help be with us and raise us and take care of us. They're doing really well. When my brother died, the boys suffered right along with me because their mom showed up. So they've been living with their estranged mother. And she kind of took them from me. They thought they were going to be with me. And the oldest was homicidal and the youngest was suicidal. And social services came in, and so I had to come in the picture. Man, that was difficult for me to let go, right, and let God. And I know that was hard for her to have me come back in to be able to support and help them bridge the gap in the healing. And now the oldest, it's funny, he had started doing marijuana and drinking. And he went with me to speak somewhere, and afterwards we went to dinner, and he said, Titi, I just wanted you to know I'm smoking weed and I'm drinking. And I always asked him, what would you like me to do with that information? And he said, I know that you'll ask me the questions that are necessary for me to look at myself so I can come up with the best answers for discernment. And we talked a little bit, and I talked a lot about the spirituality. You know, I told him what I learned here is I'm not so much concerned that you tried marijuana and alcohol. What I'm concerned is that you just lost your father, your grandfather. You live with your estranged mother. You used to be in varsity, now you're in junior varsity. You lived on a seminary in Minnesota. Now you're in Burbank, California. People are making fun of you and talking about you and calling you names. The girl you like doesn't want anything to do with you. You're only thinking about sex and sports. That's what happens at that age. That's all they think about is sex and sports. Your hormones are off the chain, man, and I'm just concerned that marijuana and alcohol is going to give you the oxygen you desperately need. So I just suggested to him that we utilize some other tools and that when he's okay on the inside, then he could try marijuana. And he talked about the spiritual path, and this is what we experience here. He said, I have friends who have invited me to church and to practice these spiritual tools, but it seems so much harder, Titi. It's so much easier to just pick up a drink and forget about everything. And we talked about that, and I'm grateful to say today he's going to the church and he's getting support from his friends, and they have a program that does the 12 steps, and he's doing inventory and working on that, and it's just beautiful to see him grow, you know, on the inside. And the youngest has been suicidal. He attempted 4 times. I know that was hard for his mom, for him to hang out with me in his last attempt. And I just listened to him. And I just, what I learned from you was without judgment, without criticism, just listen and tell me what your fantasy is about dying and what is that all about for you. And the freedom he got and not having the secret and sharing and, you know, and how the mind works. And after our conversation is long, I'm running out of time, but it was really good. Afterwards, I checked back with him, so how you doing with that? And he was like, now I'm thinking about my purpose, which is beautiful. And he is. He just finished doing a mixtape. He did his music and he put that voice or that pain in music and in his writing. And all that pain, man, it's something to listen to him. You know what I mean? Describe the pain of losing his dad and everything he's been through. But I'm so grateful that he found a vehicle of expression. And so I'm so proud of these boys, and I owe it all to Alcoholics Anonymous. They are the new generation. They haven't come anywhere near the way the family was that I grew up in. They have an opportunity for a new way of life. And we get to be a demonstration of that, and I get to be a demonstration of the practice of these tools and this power and pass that on to them, and you gave me that, you know? And recently, and where I'm at today, I'm going through a lot, and I've been going through a lot for a long time. And sometimes that's why I don't want to share. I'd rather just, you know, talk to only my sponsor. But life's been hard for me. And so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous have helped me tremendously and have showed up. And I get these angels that come around, whether it's groceries or a dollar or two, and help pay my rent. And but I've been very sick as a result of all this, you know, for whatever reason at this age, the doctors are telling me that the damage that happened to me as a child through alcohol and drugs are now affecting my nervous system. Fetal alcohol syndrome is manifesting in different ways. I'm having PTSD and physical pain. It's an interesting experience I'm having, especially since I am present, awake, and aware and sober. And I get to do that sober. And I put one hand in God and one hand in Alcoholics Anonymous. And some days I'm not okay. And like I tell my nephew, the days that I'm not is the days I look for you. I don't look for the light at the end of the tunnel. I look for somebody with a flashlight. Yeah. And recently all that's happened. Just 60 days ago, my landlord came to me. I finally found somewhere I was safe for 6 years. I've been living there. I feel safe. And I didn't even know what living at home felt like, you know. That's what my sponsee told me. She said, no, that's what it feels like when you're at home. I was like, really? I didn't know. I felt good there. She said, no, it's how when you're at home, that's what it feels like. Well, my landlord came to me and said, you have to move. We want our house back for our son. And so I've just spent the last 60 days packing up stuff that I've had for 6 years there and with nowhere to go. Not financially in a position to go anywhere else. And so I am currently homeless. And so I come to you from California, staying in one of my sponsee's parents' little room. All of my things are in storage. I didn't even have clothes. I've had to dig out clothes from the trash. I went and got this from the store on the little bit left that I had on my credit card so I can look halfway decent. I haven't been comfortable and I haven't slept well. I've been having my little powwows with God. Do really hard to not get into self-pity and depression. But I also don't want to be as sick as my secrets. I know there are people who die in the room sometimes trying to act like ain't nothing wrong when something is. I'm not going to let that happen to me. I'm not getting loaded for nobody. I wouldn't have come here to speak in the afternoon. I'm tired, but I showed up anyway. I figured I could spend the rest of the weekend just kind of being silent and sitting with God and seeing where I'm going from here. My disease is doing double time on me right now. This is a life and death errand, and I am fighting for my sobriety.
And I'm cleaning house, trusting in God, being of service, cleaning house, trusting in God, being of service.
And I got sponsees calling me, talking about my boss looked at me funny. Just recently, some girl texted me. I don't know if she's here. If you are, I'm telling your story. But I have to say, she did an instant message, and she said, I'm doing my inventory, and I'm going to drink, and I want to drink. I'm going to take a drink, she said. I'm going to take a drink. It's bringing up emotions or something in my inventory, and I don't want to finish. I'm just going to go drink. And I told her, if anybody's taking a drink around here, it's me. Okay, I'm sorry. That poor girl, I didn't hear from her afterwards. I told her, look, this is what I tell my sponsees, all right? Unless you can top me, then you can have a drink. But as far as I'm concerned, I just buried my father, my brother, my uncle. I take care of my mother, who is mommy's aunt. We're going back in the past. That's a whole other conversation. Mommy is abusing me. I can't even explain it right now. But we're going way back. Mommy's on a mission. And I'm praying real hard. And no, I can't have a go anywhere. I tell people, ask me what I've done before you tell me what I need to do. No, with my mom. I told her, that's happening. I'm homeless. I'm financially bankrupt and broke. Not out of self-will. Because that's what happens in life when people are sick. And with that, I haven't gotten loaded. Okay? So unless you can top that, all right, your ass needs to finish your inventory and shut up. That's what I told her. That poor girl, she was like, oh my God. That poor girl, I was very insensitive. I'm like, you're just having some feelings. Wait. I want to end with this. You know, this really stood out for me. I've been really emotional. I'm just real sensitive right now. So much is going on. I just look forward to the day when somebody asks me, Teresa, how are you doing? I'm like, oh my God, fantastic. I got great things happening. Like I see people doing stuff on Facebook. You guys always look like you have fun on Facebook. Everybody's having fun on Facebook. But this is what's really stood out to me. I was doing a 10-11 step work with my sponsee, and it's amazing how you can go through this work over and over again. That's why it's so awesome working with others, and that is the greatest gift if you knew. I hope you continue to do this. It's something you never want to miss. If all else fails, you work with another alcoholic, right? The only thing that ensures permanent sobriety is working with another alcoholic. I'm so grateful that my sponsees haven't said, I don't want you to sponsor me anymore because you're going through so much. They call me even more when I'm going through things. But I was going through the reading with my sponsee, and what really stood out was that it said that this is the miracle for us. And this has been my experience. That despite how I feel or what's going on in my life, the miracle is this, that in that moment where my heart feels like it's being ripped apart, or there's times where I don't know where I'm living or where I'm going or how I'm eating or how I'm going to survive, not a thought occurs to me to drink. Without any effort on my part, I'm in awe of that gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. That even when there are times I have question mark of the God of my understanding, I'm so grateful that I know that I am an alcoholic, because in knowing that or being clear about that, there's hope for me yet. But I want the newcomer to know that the miracle is that regardless of what's going on in my life, I think I'm really emotional about that. Like, who does that? How does an alcoholic like me, who lived and breathed nothing but alcohol and only knew alcohol to exist, goes through all these things in life where you're watching the person you love take their last breath and not a thought occurs to me to drink? How does that happen?
That is the miracle.
But there's a disclaimer if you're new. It says this is only true for us if we are in fit spiritual condition. Thank God for the tools of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God for you. So I'd like to thank you for allowing the God in you to help discover the God in me.
So that I, in return, can do the same for others. So here I am. I'm sober. I fight hard to look for gratitude. And I want to thank you all so much for doing a 12-step call on me and helping me to stay sober today. Thank you so much.